listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest says the impasse between the Bad River Tribal Council and the oil company Enbridge could spark the next big pipeline protests.
First, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett has called on Governor Walker and state lawmakers to finally accept federal funding to expand the state's Medicaid system, Badger Care.
Mayor Barrett says that the state made a mistake by not accepting the money when it was originally offered. He says that misstep has cost the state nearly $700 million and that it could have put that money toward other programs in the state.
We talked to Mayor Barrett yesterday morning to get his take on Badger Care and his thoughts on the violent offense that took place in Charlottesville over the weekend. Mayor Barrett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you.
Well, you said recently the state is on the hook for $700 million that it didn't need to be because it didn't accept the Medicaid expansion money. Where does that figure come from, first of all?
It comes from the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, who did an analysis of what would have happened if the governor and the legislature had accepted the expansion that so many other states, even states that had Republican governors and Republican legislatures, had accepted. Now, going forward, it makes even less sense for us to reject this, because Governor Walker's argument against taking the money initially was that he disdained Obamacare and President Obama so much that he did not want to accept this money because he thought the federal government would renege on this. Now what's happened, of course, is with President Trump, you've got Republican governors all over the country who are making it clear that they want to continue to provide health care to their residents. So it looks even less likely now than it did several years ago that this money is going to be taken away. In fact, I would say Badger Care and at the national level Medicaid probably has more support than it has had in many, many years. So looking forward, I saw an estimate recently that said it would cost our taxpayers between $150 to $200 million a year going forward to reject these funds.
But Governor Walker's initial argument for rejecting in large part was because, and you alluded to this, this was uncertain whether that money would still be there. We might be on the hook and then have to figure out how to pay for it ourselves. I mean, if anything, isn't the Affordable Care Act more uncertain now than ever?
Well, no, because I think what we saw, we've now seen 8 months of gnashing of teeth by the Republicans. But the one thing that has been very, very clear is the votes are not there to repeal the expansion that has occurred in those states that have expanded. And in fact, if anything, I'd say those states have a strengthened hand more than anything else to make sure that they're not going to have their residents lose their health care. So ironically, it's the Republican governors around the country who have been the ones, more than anyone, who have made the case that they want to continue to provide health care for those individuals who have been receiving the health care.
If you can talk about alternate history for a bit, where would we be now, as you see it, if we had taken that money right off the bat?
Well, where we would be is we'd be in the same place. In fact, we'd be in a much better place financially. We'd have the $770, $780 million that could have gone to health care or property tax relief or income tax relief or education. And that would have benefited us enormously, and you would have had people having health care. The other factor that comes into play here is the fact that one thing that is clear, and that is particularly with President Trump, is the exchanges are under attack. And those are the private providers who are working to make sure that people have health insurance. And even in Wisconsin, we've seen this threatened with a couple of providers who have now announced that they're going to pull out. With those individuals who are currently getting health care from the private exchanges in a situation where it's going to be more expensive for them to get it, or they won't be able to get it at all, that makes the case even stronger for us to take the expansion so that we can cover individuals. And keep in mind, we're talking about people who are working. These are not people who are not working. We're talking about people essentially between 100% of poverty and 133% of poverty. Those are the people who are struggling to provide for their families. And by taking this expanded health care, the money that the federal government has offered all the states, we would do two things. One, we would provide more health care for more Wisconsinites. And second, we would save our residents literally hundreds of millions of dollars. To me, it defies logic that you would go forward now and say, well, we're going to have more people uninsured and it's going to cost our residents even more than it has in the past.
Talking to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett about Medicaid and federal funding, how the lack of Medicaid expansion funding, the state's refusal to accept it, has affected the state. Mayor Barrett, for this to happen now, just like it would have had to happen years ago, Republicans would have to get on board. They've got a budget plan. It doesn't include taking this federal Medicaid expansion money. Have you talked to any Republicans in state government who would be on board with this?
Well, they certainly haven't shown any signs of it, but I think what's happened that makes this so timely and so dramatically different is when the Senate went home for its August recess, the United States Senate, not the Wisconsin State Senate, when the United States Senate went home for its August recess, that to me was the loudest signal yet that they are not in a position where they're going to repeal Obamacare, but even more importantly, even if they were to repeal Obamacare, the conversations have been that they're going to protect the states that have expanded Medicaid, or in our case, what would be expanded Badger Care. And so we are in a position now, I think, where the argument that the governor and the legislature was making 4 or 5 years ago is even weaker now than it was then. Because now this issue is front and center. And I was just looking at an article this morning that said Medicaid. And again, when we talk about Medicaid in Wisconsin, we're talking about Badger mm-hmm. Care that is more popular than it has been in the past because about 1 in 5 people benefit from the Medicaid system.
But have you had a conversation with any Republicans in the last few weeks here in Wisconsin that suggests that it could happen?
I certainly mentioned it to them. I don't know that they're there, and that's why I think mm-hmm. it's important to talk about it. I know Congressman Kind has talked about this. I know others have talked about this. This is the time, because the budget is not yet completed, where you could fill a lot of holes in this budget by announcing that you are going to reverse the position and start having these dollars go to provide health care for more Wisconsinites.
How do you see this affecting your city of Milwaukee in particular?
Well, we've got some great things going on in the city of Milwaukee, and I'm proud to be the cheerleader. But I think, as everybody realizes, we're also the area that has the largest percentage of low-income people. Many of these individuals are people who are working for a living. And I just have to stress that over and over again. People are covered in the state of Wisconsin up to 100% of poverty. It's the working poor, those individuals who are struggling between 100% of poverty and 133% of poverty, that would benefit by this the most in terms of health care. But all residents in Milwaukee and throughout the state certainly would have benefited if we hadn't forfeited that nearly $700 million. And looking forward, it's going to be all Wisconsin residents, including Milwaukeeans, who are going to benefit by not turning our back to $150 to $200 million per year that we could be receiving from the federal government and providing health care at the same time.
Assuming the state doesn't take this Medicaid expansion money to expand Badger Care between now and then, do you think this is or should be an issue in the 2018 elections?
Oh, I think it should be front and center in the 2018 elections. How can any elected official defend the fact that they have forfeited, first of all, close to $700 million, and second, going forward, that they're going to continue to forfeit $150 to $200 million per year? To me, that should be right there. And at the same time, not providing the health care for individuals. So whether you're a fiscal hawk or whether you're someone who cares about health care, they're on the same side. They should be on the same side of this issue because it's a fiscal issue and it's a health care issue.
I want to shift gears away from Medicaid for just a few moments and get your reaction to this weekend's events in Charlottesville. What are your thoughts about what happened there this weekend?
Well, obviously, I think anybody who saw what happened there has to stand up and say, this is just insanity to have this hatred so present in our society. And it has to start with the President of the United States. The President of the United States has to condemn the white supremacists. It defies logic that he has not condemned it yet.
And I'm sorry, just in the last few minutes, he did specify, we're talking, I should say, Monday morning, he did specify listing the KKK, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis. I was unable to hear the whole speech because I've been here talking with you now. What more would you like to see now at the federal level?
I think the leadership has to come there, and it has to be a genuine leadership, not one where you're forced to do it. I'm very pleased that he finally made the statement, but I was completely flabbergasted that he hadn't made that statement until, again, hearing it from you.
And then there's a vigil this weekend in Milwaukee and other places around the country, of course. What message would you like to see sent from your city to the rest of the country?
I want, from our city, I want people to understand that we are a city that is a multiracial, multi-ethnic city with a lot of different incomes, a lot of different religions. And we do everything we can to try to be a community, that there is more that unites us than it divides us. And I think most Americans feel that way. They're not looking for ways to wedge issues between people. They want to take care of their families and move on with their lives.
Mayor Barrett, thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was Tom Barrett, mayor of Milwaukee. He joined us yesterday morning to talk about why he thinks Wisconsin should take advantage of federal funding to expand badger care.
In January of this year, the Bad River Tribal Council refused to renew easements for the oil company Enbridge. The company has oil pipelines running beneath sovereign tribal land, but the pipes are currently more than a decade past their 50-year shelf life.
That fact has our next guest worried. She sees parallels between the protests at the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota and the current situation with Enbridge and the Bad River Band.
Patty Lowe is a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and a professor in the UW Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication. She recently wrote about pipeline protests for Madison Magazine. Patty, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, the Dakota Access Pipeline protest started before the Bad River Tribal Council refused easements to the oil company Enbridge. What were your thoughts as you watched the protest in North Dakota unfold?
Like a lot of people, Native and non-Native, I was really disturbed by what I saw. And for me, being a child of the 50s and remembering the Black civil rights struggle and the violence surrounding the effort to register Black voters, I remembered images of water cannons and attack dogs being unleashed on Black voters. And those were the same images that I saw at the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Had a report that happened right around the beginning of September. And then the week of Thanksgiving, ironically, the Morton County Sheriff unleashed water cannons on water protectors or demonstrators, depending on which perspective you're looking, either protesters or water protectors. But there were water cannons that were fired on them in sub-freezing temperatures. And all I could think about was what I remembered of the South growing up when I was a really impressionable age.
Now, you didn't yourself go to the protests. You had obligations that kept you in Wisconsin, but from afar, were you surprised to see these protests draw such a huge coalition of people to support those who were protesting the pipeline?
You know, I was somewhat surprised at the volume. At one point, I think CNN estimated that 10,000 people had been in those camps. But I wasn't surprised that the issue was coalescing at the time it was, because, you know, there are 566 federally recognized Indian nations in the United States, and I would venture to guess a vast majority of them have had environmental issues in which they were trying to protect their air and water quality and found themselves up against impossible corporate and governmental odds. And I know that, you know, it was ironic for me because the Ojibwe and the Sioux have not exactly been, you know, the best of friends historically. And yet there were a lot of Ojibwe people who traveled there to support the Standing Rock Sioux.
Why do you think it is that clean water and water rights in particular has emerged, it seems, as a focal point for Native American activists and for other activists?
Well, I think we've seen so many ecological disasters, from the the disaster in the Gulf to the Enbridge spill in the Kalamazoo River, which caused nearly $1 billion worth of damage. We've seen oil trains explode. Excuse me. And so we've seen the kinds of environmental disasters that have compromised people's water supplies. The Navajo, for example, had a major waterway contaminated with uranium. A lot of Indian nations have experienced environmental threats that have compromised their way of life, that have compromised their resources. And so what happened at Standing Rock, where people stood up and said, "You're not going to compromise my water," I think really resonated.
We're talking with Patty Lowe right now, member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication, talking about protests and pipelines and what that could mean in Wisconsin in particular for the Bad River Band and the Enbridge pipeline going through Bad River land. Let's get to that now, mm-hmm. Patty. What makes this different than the Dakota Access Pipeline?
The Dakota Access Pipeline was on disputed treaty lands north of the reservation. The Enbridge Line 5 pipeline is indisputably, is clearly on our sovereign land, and it traverses the entire width of our 120 acres from west to east. It's carrying millions of gallons of crude oil in a pipeline that people who have worked on it tell us had a 50-year life expectancy, and we're now in year 64. And this isn't, I mean, when you think about oil through a pipeline, if you have a mental image of cooking oil flowing through, that's not what this is. I mean, this is crude oil that hasn't been refined yet. It's gritty. It's full of tar and stones and guck. And there's a lot of chemicals that have to be used in order to treat create a viscosity that will allow it to flow through the pipes. And so that grit, along with the oil, is moving through these pipes that are old. And we are in an extremely important environmentally sensitive area. Our 120,000 acres contains 71 acres of wild rice that is crucial. This is where Lake Superior's lake trout spawn. Commercial fishing is at stake. This is where people get their drinking water out of Shawamigan Bay. And we're trying to protect our way of life, of course, but we're trying to protect our water not just for ourselves, but for everybody in the area, because, you know, clean water and clean air doesn't know reservation boundaries. And so we're thinking about this regionally and trying to create a sustainable environment that will support the people of northern Wisconsin, as well as the natural resources.
And so this time, the Bad River Tribal Council said no to the easements,
right.
And that left... Where do things stand now with Enbridge?
So 11 of the 15 easements that are necessary for the pipeline to operate across our reservation are held by the Bad River Band. Some of the easements are on allotted land or land that isn't tribally controlled. The easements expired in 2013, and our tribal council has voted not to renew the easements and has told Enbridge that we want them to stop the flow, dig up the pipe, and leave. They are not doing that.
And they asked for the chance to remediate, to make it better.
Right. And, you know, one of our elders, I happened to be up at Bad River over spring break when the Army Corps of Engineers came into our council meeting and on behalf of Enbridge asked for the right to fix four anomalies. Asked on behalf, Enbridge wanted to come out of the reservation and fix four quote-unquote anomalies. And one of our elders stood up and said, you know, I don't think you get it. You know, we're telling you you're evicted, and you're telling us you want permission to come in and fix a leaky faucet and repaint the bedrooms. We want you gone. So right now, the tribe and Enbridge, through a third party, is negotiating how an exit would take place and whether the pipeline would be left in the ground. It would be very expensive for the company to dig it up, but we are telling them we want them gone. Along with that, there's an assessment that's being done right now on the geological and natural resources that would be compromised if there was a spill. A really sensitive. We have miles and miles and miles of Lake Superior shoreline. We have 100 miles of rivers. We've got wetlands, very sensitive wetlands, and so we want the company to understand you're dealing with a sovereign entity. It's not like it was in 1963 when we weren't asserting that sovereignty. This is different now, and it's quite clear the courts have affirmed our right to protect our sovereign land, and they need to deal with us in a different way than they did 50 years ago.
And so, Patty, this is a big question in our last 30 seconds, but you point out that Native Americans don't own the land. The reservations are on outright. It's held in trust by the federal government. So, very briefly, is this the end of it?
Well, yes. Yeah, I mean, yes, that's an important question. Yes, that's not the end of it, because, I think there was a little bit of security having a blue White House, and now, of course, that's changed. And so we'll have to wait and see. I'm not sure that anyone wants the issue to go to the U.S. Supreme Court, given the makeup these days. But we'll just have to wait and hope that ethics and good sense prevail.
Patty, thanks a lot for coming into the studio.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Patty Lowe is a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and a professor in the UW-Madison Department of Life Sciences Communication.
Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said yesterday that the nation could abandon its nuclear agreement with world powers if the United States imposes any new sanctions. Meanwhile, mid-August was North Korea's self-imposed deadline for a missile demonstration, but now dictator Kim Jong-un said he's not going to fire missiles at this time, according to state media. The decision comes after his announcement last week that North Korea would strike near the U.S. territory of Guam.
Valerie Lindsay is the executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. Valerie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with Iran. What was your reaction to President Rouhani's comments about the potential to pull out of the nuclear deal?
Well, I suppose it was the remarks were sort of predictable given the escalating nature of the rhetoric between the United States and Iran on the nuclear agreement. So you have President Trump saying that this is a terrible deal and that the United States needs to get out of it, and then you have the Iranian president saying much the same thing.
And we have a little bit of President Trump's comments about the deal.
It was a terrible agreement. It shouldn't have been signed. It shouldn't have been negotiated the way it was negotiated. I'm all for agreements, but that was a bad one, as bad as I've ever seen negotiated. They are not living up to the spirit of the agreement, I can tell you that. And we're analyzing it very, very carefully, and we'll have something to say about it in the not-too-distant future. But Iran has not lived up to the spirit of the agreement, and they have to do that. They have to do that.
And Valerie, what is it that the president objects to about the Iran nuke deal?
Well, there are some issues with the deal itself, which I should say are narrowly focused on Iran's nuclear program. So just, this was a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, that the agreement was concluded, and the idea was that Iran would restrict certain parts of its nuclear program, the most worrisome parts from a nuclear weapons point of view, for a period of time, and in exchange would receive sanctions relief. And so on those very narrow measures, the deal is largely functioning. But when the president refers to, Iran respecting the spirit of the agreement, he's referring to things like Iranian activism in the region, Iranian ballistic missile tests, Iran's support for terrorism, for the regime of Bashar al-Assad in Syria, and things like that, so that the agreement, the hope that the agreement would kind of constrain Iran in this behavior has not borne out.
And we've seen some movement from Iran in the terrain of ballistic missiles. What's been happening there?
Well, there was the test of a space launch vehicle a few weeks ago, which is of concern because it has a relevance for ballistic missiles in terms of technology. And then there have been a number of other ballistic missile tests since the agreement was concluded. But again, the agreement itself does not specifically address Iran's ballistic missile program. And so you have Iran saying that this is not a violation of the agreement. And you have the United States saying, yes, but the ballistic missile program is intended to develop nuclear weapons, and the history of Iran's nuclear program and its ballistic missile program are intertwined, and so you're pursuing this, which is really against the spirit of the nuclear agreement.
And the U.S. just signed into law new sanctions on Iran, Russia, and North Korea. Can you tell us about what the sanctions are and what their function is?
Yeah, so on Iran, the sanctions are, I would say, focused on the areas that the nuclear agreement doesn't cover, which are really the areas of great concern right now. Iran's support for terrorism, Iran's expanding ballistic missile program, the work of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps in Syria, Yemen, and other places. And so the sanctions in that law with respect to Iran have to do with those areas. And then, as you mentioned, the law also includes sanctions on Russia, in particular Russian energy development at projects with Russian energy companies. And then on North Korea, it essentially codifies a lot of things that were already in place with regard to North Korea's nuclear and missile program.
And looking forward, I mean, Iran has said that they would withdraw quickly. I think the quote was something a matter of hours.
Right.
Is that going too far with the statement there from Iran? Could it really be dissolved in a matter of hours, or is this something that would take months or at least weeks to unravel?
Well, in terms of Iran's ability to start doing the things that the nuclear program restricts, it could start doing those things immediately. But in order for Iran to reconstitute its program, its nuclear program, and get it to the place where it was when the nuclear agreement was implemented, that would not take hours. That would take months, potentially even years, depending on what your calculation is of Iran's capability. So yes, Iran could walk away from the agreement just as we could or any of the other parties to the agreement, because remember what the administration may sometimes not remember is that there are six countries party to this agreement, not just the U.S. and Iran, but also Russia, China, France, Germany, and the U.K.
And we're talking to Valerie Lindsay right now, executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. And we're talking about nuclear proliferation from Iran and North Korea. And moving on now to North Korea, state media there reported that dictator Kim Jong-un looked at plans to attack Guam but decided not to fire missiles, said he wanted to wait and see what the United States did. What do you think is behind that particular decision?
Well, it's very difficult to know for sure. I mean, there's a lot of speculation. One possibility is that this is very different. Threatening to target a particular place is very different from conducting a missile test. And whether North Korea can accurately fire a missile and hit Guam is, for some people, a question mark. And perhaps there was a concern that the targeting would not be successful, and North Korea's leverage over the United States would therefore go down. But there are other people who are suggesting that this is an opening for the United States, that North Koreans are perhaps willing to negotiate in some narrow way on the missile program, and so that's perhaps another possibility. But again, it's when it comes to North Korea, very difficult to say exactly what's motivating a decision.
For those watching these rising tensions in the last couple of weeks, it seemed as though there's always been tension with North Korea, but that things escalated very quickly. Can you give us a little of the backstory on what led to that last week?
Well, there's been a kind of an escalating rhetorical back and forth. You had a series of North Korean missile tests of increasing gravity in terms of the ability of those missiles to reach the United States. So again, there's disagreement about exactly how far North Korea's missiles could fly, whether they could accurately reach a target in the United States, and in particular the lower 48 states. But the idea is that North Korea is aggressively pursuing its ballistic missile program. it's aggressively trying to miniaturize its nuclear weapons so that it could fit on a missile. And then the question is, could it use those missiles to deliver a nuclear warhead and hit a target in the United States? And so the last couple of weeks have seen North Korea make improvements on that front. And then you have, in response, the United States imposing sanctions, also the United Nations imposing sanctions. And so then you have some of the rhetoric of President Trump and of Kim Jong-un on the North Korea side. And so you have this sort of escalating both capabilities, escalating, but also the rhetoric.
We're talking with Valerie Lindsay. She stays with us. She's executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control. And we're talking about nuclear proliferation from Iran to North Korea.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What kind of policy on nuclear proliferation should the United States have? Should the U.S. back out of the Iran nuclear deal? How would you like to see the U.S. government respond to North Korea's nuclear program? Call in now. Share your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and take your calls in just a little bit on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're picking up our conversation with Valerie Lindsay from the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control about nuclear proliferation.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think the U.S. should do to respond to nuclear proliferation in other countries? How do you think the U.S. should handle nuclear ambitions in Iran? What do you think the Iran deal, President Trump's plans maybe to try to get out of it? What about North Korea? What kind of nuclear policy would you like to see the U.S. adopt? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Valerie, when North Korea initially threatened to attack Guam last week, President Trump had this to say.
North Korea best not make any more threats to the United States. They will be met with fire and fury like the world has never seen. He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
And Valerie, very strong rhetoric there from President Trump. Also in recent days, a strong response from President Moon in South Korea, almost being read as a rebuke to President Trump. What do you see about his comments?
About President Trump's comments?
President Moon's comments to President Trump.
President Moon's comments. Well, it shows the sort of delicate balance in the region and how the United States can both reinforce its alliances and its treaty commitments with South Korea and with Japan, contribute to sort of the diplomatic process and trying to resolve the conflict with North Korea in a diplomatic fashion while remaining, continuing to have a strong response to statements that the North Korean leader has made. So it's always been a delicate balance. I would say that this particular administration has certainly amped up the rhetoric as compared to past administrations. But when you look at the language of Secretary of State Tillerson, Secretary of Defense Mattis, you see that there is this desire to sort of maintain balance and understanding that the alliances and the responsibilities that the United States has with South Korea and with Japan require a certain amount of diplomacy and tact. You had them, for instance, arguing in an op-ed recently about switching from this notion of strategic patience as the U.S. policy to strategic accountability. So maybe more of a response, holding North Korea more accountable, staying less on the sidelines, but at the same time, you know, not any sort of a militaristic type response.
And it seems as though there hasn't been one consistent message from the White House. We heard President Trump there talking about fire and fury, and then in subsequent days we heard messages which were more tempered. So how does that read to North Korea?
Well, it reads to North Korea like it reads to a lot of the rest of the world, which is with uncertainty, which I would say is the most worrisome part of what's happening with North Korea, which is that you have escalating tensions and an increasing amount of uncertainty. and therefore an increasing chance of misunderstanding and miscalculation on our part and on the North Korean part.
So you said one possible tack would be holding North Korea accountable. What would that look like?
Well, you see things like greater action first at the United Nations, and here you have a continuity with the policy of the past administration, of the Obama administration. So broadening the sanctions at the United Nations to include more sectors of the North Korean economy, imposing bans on North Korean exports of not only coal but also iron ore and other things, seafood, lead. So if North Korea's main trading partner, China, can be brought on board to these types of export bans, then that could have a real financial impact on North Korea. It may not immediately reverse their program, but it may well make it difficult for them to raise funds to fuel the program and make them more, perhaps more willing to participate in useful negotiations.
Now, sanctions on North Korea in the past haven't seen as especially effective. Do you think that this would be different?
It certainly has to be tried. I think it could be different, again, if we can get China to be more committed to the sanctions. And this administration has shown itself willing to directly punish Chinese, for instance, Chinese financial institutions that are continuing to be a lifeline to North Korea. And so if China does not do more now in the context of the new UN sanctions, we could see more direct U.S. sanctions on Chinese companies dealing with North Korea, and in particular, Chinese banks dealing with North Korea.
And Valerie,
I'm sorry, just to wrap up, yeah. I think that those types of sanctions could indeed be effective.
Before we wrap up, we've been talking about North Korea, we've been talking about Iran. Let's talk a little bit about nuclear weapon threats that aren't getting as much attention as Iran and North Korea. Where else should we be focusing attention?
Well, India and Pakistan, for instance. These are two neighbors, both with nuclear weapons, both with a number of different missiles that they're able to use to deliver nuclear weapons. They have an ongoing border conflict. Both countries are increasing the size of their nuclear weapons stockpile, the size of the fuel that can be used to make nuclear weapons, the size of the stockpile of fuel that can be used to make nuclear weapons. And there's not a great deal of attention paid to this problem. And, you know, as a non-proliferation organization, we're very concerned about the risk of more escalation and of potentially a nuclear conflict between these two countries.
Do you think there's been too much focus on North Korea and Iran and not enough focus on India and Pakistan?
Clearly, the North Korean program is of great concern, and over the last couple of months, an even greater concern. And the past policy of the strategic patients has led that has created an even bigger problem in North Korea. So I'm certainly not arguing that we should be ignoring North Korea. I do think, coming back to Iran, that the Iran nuclear deal, while it has a number of problems with it, is at the moment containing the most worrisome parts of Iran's nuclear program. And so the idea that at this point in time we would just walk away from the agreement, which the Trump administration has threatened, I don't think is in the U.S. national security interest, because of the fact that it is sort of doing the job of containing Iran right now on the nuclear front.
Valerie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Valerie Lindsay is the executive director of the Wisconsin Project on Nuclear Arms Control, joining us there to talk about nuclear proliferation from Iran to North Korea. And you can keep that conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.
The Wisconsin beer industry is well known, but the wine industry is growing. In 2015, there were nearly 1.8 million visits to wineries here in the state. Bridget Bowden has more on what's behind the growth in this installment of WPR's State of Change series.
Early on a Monday morning, volunteers are uncorking dozens of wine bottles in a basement on the UW-Madison campus. They're preparing 93 local wines for judging in the first annual Wine is Wisconsin competition.
Yeah, we're here to prove that these are amazing wines and they're available using local fruits.
That's Nick Smith, the university's enology outreach specialist. Enology is the study of wine. He says all the wines in the competition had to be made with at least 75% Wisconsin-grown fruit.
I think sparkling and rosés are probably two of our best options for a lot of our varieties, just because of the sugar and acid profile, but people make a wide range of wines from apples, fruits, grapes, red wines, white wines, sparkling wines, rosés.
According to data from the State Department of Revenue, there are 124 permitted wineries in the state. That's three times as many as there were 10 years ago.
Part of it is availability of grapes that can be grown in northern climates.
In the last couple of decades, several new types of grapes have been developed by universities and private breeders. They're known as cold hardy, meaning they can withstand extreme winters and still make great wine. As a flight of wine comes out from the kitchen, the judges list the grapes that are in each wine they're about to taste.
Next wine, 50% Frontenac-Ri, 30% La Crescent, and 20% Frontenac Blanc.
Irvin Pechkowski is the president of the Wisconsin Vintners Association, which is an amateur group stewarding the competition. He says the climate in Wisconsin creates some problems for winemaking.
The whites and the reds all come up very high in acid. And they also don't have the tannins that the Cabernets and Merlots and Zins and all that stuff have out from California.
But there are some newer grape varieties that capture what people like about wines like Cabernet, and they're also cold hardy. Matt Clark studies grape breeding and enology at the University of Minnesota, which has developed many of these grape varieties. He says the breeding process doesn't happen overnight.
It's an extensive process. It requires a number of years of testing.
Breeders are looking for grapes that can survive extremely cold winters and late spring frosts. They should thoroughly ripen in the short summer months and, of course, make good wine.
After about 5 years, we had an opportunity to taste the grapes from each plant, and at which point we decide, well, maybe we should make wine from that, or the alternative is that we get rid of that plant and it goes to the compost pile.
As they look ahead, breeders and growers are also thinking about the potential impacts of climate change on Midwestern grapes. Clark says he still expects to need grapes that can stand up to cold winters.
Even though we intend to experience higher temperatures on average, things that we do need to be concerned about are still major weather events, increased rain, increased drought events, extended periods of either of those, in addition to still having regular cold weather occurring every winter.
Dairy and cranberries may get a lot of attention in Wisconsin, but an increasing number of people also want to buy local wine. According to the U of M report, cold hardy grapes contributed more than $71 million to Wisconsin's economy in 1 year. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at Wisconsin Public Radio called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, here on the Ideas Network, and online at wpr.org/change.